Stan Hootie with the Daily Gazette family of newspapers. As a journalist, photographer for the past 25 years in the Capital Region, I've had the opportunity to meet hundreds, if not thousands, of people in my travels. That engagement has led to numerous interesting and memorable conversations with people. That led me to this point now, letting those interesting people tell their stories. This newly launched podcast is simply named Tell Me Your Story. This project is designed to introduce you, the listeners, to people you may not be familiar with, but those individuals that are making a difference. It is designed to be informative, interesting, and at times, provide a few laughs. Here's to the first of hopefully many opportunities for people to tell their story. For the first Tell Me Your Story podcast, I was fortunate to sit down with Skidmore professor Winston Grady Willis, the founding director of Black Studies at Skidmore College. He left the campus in 2011 and returned with his wife in 2019. As February is recognized as Black History Month, I wanted to speak to people who embrace the month and have insight to what the month means and where they think it needs to go. Listeners, Skidmore professor Winston Grady Willis, tell me your story.
Okay. So, well, first off, thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, and, absolutely.
Again, part of this was, you know, February, you know, is Black History Month.
True.
And I wanted to reach out to people that have input, understanding, and a life
okay.
about it.
True.
And so you are the founding director of Black Studies at Skidmore College?
That's correct. Founding director. Okay. And Skidmore is a bit behind, you know, given that Black Studies has been around for so long, but when the opportunity came to interview for the position, I couldn't believe it, because my wife and I, you know, Lisa Grady Willis, we had taught here from 2008 to 2011, and I was in American Studies. She had a part-time position in the theater department. We left. Make a long story short, we were back in my hometown of Denver, Colorado, at MSU Denver for 5 years, Portland State University for 3 years. So anyway, I'm at Portland State, I'm in my office, and I see this ad for the position, and I'm like, wow, an opportunity to come back to Skidmore. And one of the reasons why we left was the absence of Black Studies or Africana Studies. And so, yeah, and so things have worked out. We've been back here since 2019. I'm director of Black Studies. She's director of the Intergroup Relations Program. And so, and in terms of Black Studies, we've had a minor for 5 years now. And one day, you know, we hope to offer a major.
Where were you before your college days at Skidmore?
Well, I grew up in Denver. I had aspirations, interestingly enough, to be a newspaper reporter, perhaps a columnist. Someday, I even had a chance to intern with the old Rocky Mountain News. And so that was my junior year in college. So I grew up in Denver, but went to school on the East Coast, was undergraduate at Columbia. And something happened between my junior and senior years. I began to really explore the neighborhoods in Harlem. Was a volunteer at a Saturday school program, and I started to think about teaching. And so, sure enough, I was really fortunate. I interviewed for a position to be a school teacher at IS 175 in Harlem. And Miss Foster, who was the principal, bless her heart, you know, she took a chance on me. And that first year as a school teacher, I was abysmal. I was awful. I was absolutely, I don't think I did a single child any good whatsoever. Or at least that's the way I feel. But unbeknownst to me, this middle school was an alternative school, which meant everyone in District 5 that had been kicked out of every other middle school was sent there. And so really, I had no business being there. But anyway, so I was a school teacher. there for a year, a couple more years in the Bronx at CIS 229. That's kind of when I really kind of came into my own as a school teacher. But decided, you know, I think I'm either going to be in this long term, or maybe I should think about going back to school. And so that's when I applied to a couple of graduate programs. It was a master's program at Cornell in Africana Studies. And so I was accepted there and, you know, went there in, what was it? Fall of 1990. And, you know, it was the best decision I ever made, not only intellectually, but more important, I met Lisa Grady at Cornell, was a fellow grad student. And, you know, we've been together, married 32 years, been together for 34.
And you talked about early on, you talked about you were here at Skidmore, but then you left because the opportunity wasn't here.
Yeah.
And what went into that decision? Did you have the ability and did you voice your concerns, your cares, and say, listen, I think the community needs this? You know, how did that go?
Yeah. Well, I tell you, the interesting thing is, so my first tenure track teaching position was at Syracuse. And so I was there 10 years and, you know, was really fortunate, worked with some amazing people, particularly mentors, Ms. Sherry Mugo and Linda Carty, Horace Campbell. But the Skidmore position, the thing that I was really curious about, so it was an American Studies, a teaching appointment, but the position was something called the Director of Intercultural Studies. And so to this day, if you ask me, what exactly is intercultural studies? You know, I'll smile and think, well, you know, it's a number of different things to a number of different people. But concretely, I was the member of a three-person diversity team. So there was somebody in human resources, Herb Crossman, and then there was someone in student affairs, Mary L. Martin. And so we worked together, tried to kind of chart a course for accountability for the institution to kind of move forward in that way. And, you know, things went fairly well, but one of the push factors, in addition to this absence of Black studies, was, I don't know if you remember the Compton's incident, when, you know, some Skidmore students were arrested. The initial narrative was that they jumped this patron in the diner. A few of us did some more research. Sue Layden, who was an amazing colleague at the time, was able to get someone, a private investigator, to do some digging. And so the things got a little more complicated. There were some more layers. Found out that the patron was a bouncer at a local bar. There were some other things. So we basically said, look, let's complicate this narrative. From what we see, these young people, these Skidmore students, were, in many ways, they were simply acting in self-defense. So there was a whole back and forth. As you probably know, there was a key moment when we were able to get a pro bono attorney, and the attorney is advising the students in the courthouse and to basically really consider taking this misdemeanor, you know, cop the plea. This will be off your record in a couple of years. And the young men, I mean, to a person, one was from the Bronx, a couple were from Brooklyn. One young man, I remember because his father was there. We were, he said, look, Dad, I didn't do anything wrong. It's like, I want to go to trial. I want to clear my name. And then the attorney said, well, this is the reality. You're in Saratoga County. You're in a county that's 98% white. You don't know what's going to happen with the jury. You could end up going to an upstate prison for several years if found guilty. You know, and I still remember the tears streaming down his face and him finally deciding, I'll take the plea. They all graduated. They're all, you know, doing well now. But so that was kind of the push. And then the pull was that college, Access College, my hometown, Metropolitan State College of Denver, had this position for director of It was then called African and African American Studies was the name of the department. And I said, wow. You know, when Lisa and I, when we first got married, you know, she said, you know, wouldn't it be something if we could figure out a way to work where each of the kids' grandparents are? I'm like, yeah, that'd be pretty cool. And so we you know, we spent some time in New York City with Lisa's dad. Her mom had passed away some years back. And so this would be a chance to actually go to Denver where my dad and stepmom were, my brothers. And so it worked out. And so that's what got me to Denver, not only back home, but more important in some ways, particularly intellectually, back in Africana studies, African-American studies, Black studies, different names, same thing, back in that particular intellectual side again. Yeah, but then, and then after
home again.
Yeah, and then, exactly. So, and then, I mean, after the time at Portland State, School of Gender, Race, and Nations, I was director, you know, great position in name, not much power actually connected to it. Come back here, and one of the things that I love so much, when we were here from 08 to 2011, and then one of the things that absolutely brought, you know, brought us back, were Skidmore students. And I've been really, really fortunate in terms of just being able to, and this is part of what the residential liberal arts environment is about, to really develop meaningful relationships with students. I mean, there's students who went to school and graduated in 09, 2010, that I'm still in regular contact with. And that it's not something I can say with any consistency for any of the other places that I've taught. You know, there are a couple exceptions, but here, I mean, I could literally name the names of students.
Where has Black Studies grown from your time as, you know, a student?
Yeah.
As a young man?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, it's grown. It's there were times when, particularly when I was an undergrad at Columbia, Columbia didn't have a formal Black Studies or African American Studies department, unlike most of the other Ivy Leagues schools by that time. I was there from 83 to 87. And so a lot of the work that I would do was outside the classroom in terms of just doing my own reading, kind of getting a sense of things, and also being pretty active as a student activist on campus. Fast forward now, Skidmore was the last New York Six school. So, you know, Colgate, Hamilton, Hobart and William Smith colleges, Union College, St. Lawrence University, of course, Skidmore. Skidmore was the last of the six to actually have Black Studies or Africana Studies in place. You see it on so many institutions nationally. What one of the things that Black Studies did in the late 1960s is that it helped to really pave the way for other Latino studies, Chicano studies, women's studies, gender studies. Black Studies really kind of opened the door to these fields of study that my former mentor and colleague, Ms. Sherry Mugo, would call liberatory fields. And of course, there's some controversy, particularly now, because just to cut to the chase, this current assault on diversity, equity, and inclusion, gender studies, Black studies, I mean, it's palpable. I mean, it goes to what I do. And I can understand, ostensibly, why some folks, particularly if you haven't taken a course, or if you haven't had any familiarity with the courses, would say, oh, this is about indoctrination, or it's the term that folks will often use is, you know, woke ideology. And I'll simply say, it's actually an effort, particularly I can say this as a historian, to, you know, seek truth, to really explore dimensions of U.S. history, world history, that are often ignored, and that it's often a really, you know, illuminating experience, in some cases a transformative experience for students. And I tell anybody that's got any doubts, any detractor, I said, look, either audit a class or just give me a heads up, come to a class I teach, welcome to come. See for yourself. See what's actually happening in those four walls.
How has your classroom changed? Your auditoriums, your lecture halls, how they changed?
Yeah.
And has the demographic changed?
It has. Yeah, it has. The great question, when I was teaching at Syracuse, in a big university, Intro to African American Studies, I would have anywhere between 75 and 100 students in the class, would have graduate students or teaching assistants who would have recitations with them. Maybe a fourth of the students would identify as white. I'm looking now here at Skidmore. Every semester that I've taught Introduction to Black Studies, there may be a slight majority of students who self-identify as students of color, but there's always a significant number of white students as well. And so they're among the most consistently diverse courses in terms of who's in the classroom. And that's great. And what's interesting too, in terms of the students who decide to minor in Black Studies, those numbers are diverse as well. Now, I've noticed, past couple of years, more students of color minoring in Black Studies, but I know that in 2023, we had a significant number of self-identified white students who were minoring. And so it's encouraging that folks are getting something in the classroom that they didn't necessarily get in high school or in middle school, and it's often eye-opening.
February is Black History Month.
Yeah.
We hope it always will be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got that right.
Is there a difference in the month of February? Is there a vibe about February?
Yeah.
Is there an awareness
throughout
the month of February that this is Black History Month?
Well, that's a fantastic question. And, you know, kind of ebbs and flows. I think right now, it's a bit more palpable. I think that that's a good thing. But for several years, there was this kind of intra-group or intra-racial within the group, kind of a critique of February, particularly from folks who didn't know the history of Black History Month, who would say, oh, February, shortest month of the year. That's what, you know, that's all we could get, you know. But if, you know, folks who know the history, so historian Carter Goodwood, Woodson, Dr. Woodson, established the month first as, and some folks will kind of rankle at the words, but we have to be clear, we're talking about the mid-1920s, Negro History Week. That's where it started. And it was intentionally done in the week in February that included Frederick Douglass's birthday, Abraham Lincoln's birthday. And so that's why the anchor is in February. And eventually it became a full month. Now it's Black History Month, African American History Month, whatever. But it's always a special moment. I mean, even this evening on the Skidmore campus, you know, we're going to have some folks, Field Horn, local historian, and then Mary Liz and Paul Stewart from the Underground Railroad Education Center are going to talk about, you know, Black history in Saratoga. So there is an excitement. You know, students look forward to this time. And I know members of the community absolutely look forward to the events that take place on the campuses, in the libraries, you know, throughout the Capital District.
Is it enough?
Well, the answer is no. It's not enough, right? It would never be enough, just the 1 month. But it's very important symbolically, particularly in this specific moment politically, when there are individuals, and first it started with the former Confederacy, right, at the state legislative level. There are individuals that are saying, what I do for a living, what other scholars do for a living, that there's no place for that, right, that there's no greater good, that as a matter of fact, it's pernicious. Right? What started as a movement in the former Confederacy and has now gotten much, much bigger, I'd argue for that reason, what we're doing this month and every month, though it's not enough, it's absolutely necessary. And it's a reminder. It's a reminder, kind of, iron, because we're coming on almost a century that we've celebrated this. it's a reminder that it's as needed now as it was a century ago.
What more can be done? And the list may be too big.
Okay.
What would you, in your lifetime,
sure,
what would you encourage your students who are going to be making these decisions and making these in-war roads?
Sure.
What would you ask of them in their future?
Yeah. I would sincerely ask them to, one, keep reading. I mean, I've been saying this a bit, some other colleagues have too. One of the casualties of the pandemic, COVID pandemic, was that, and this goes not just to students, but for faculty, staff as well, our attention spans aren't what they were 5-6 years ago. You know, I've spoken to folks that just don't do casual reading as much as they used to now that we're out of the pandemic. But to keep reading, to have an appreciation for, you know, what scholars are doing, not only those of us with PhDs and terminal degrees, but just amazing local historians who are in archives and who are writing, who are giving talks. You know, keep reading, keep attending events, but also, and I mean this sincerely, have that classroom experience be communicated with family members, friends, colleagues at work, in terms of just the importance of this, particularly for those folks who are like, that stuff, I don't want anything to do with it. Just kind of a general reminder of, wow, you know, when you get a fuller sense of history, not only Black contributions, but also how some of the narratives we learned in elementary or middle school or high school in terms of just U.S. history, how they become complicated in ways that just kind of lead to all these epiphanies, that's the important work that has to happen. Just those casual conversations. You don't have to get in a debate in CNN with someone who may have a different point of view, but if you can just have a conversation with them and say, well, look, I tell you what, take a course or go to an event, do your own research, right? That's what critical thinking is about. I mean, this, what happens this month is absolutely foundational in terms of critical thinking. And I would argue, and maybe I'm wrong, but I would argue that there's some folks in power right now that would like to see less critical thinking in terms of the broader U.S. population and not more.
If you put on your recruiter hat, your Black Studies recruiting hat, do you want to talk to a high school senior class, junior class? Do you want to talk to high school freshmen? Do you want to talk to elementary school students about the world that they could see in Black Studies?
So the answer is easy for me. It's because the last year that I was a school teacher, got to teach fifth grade. And the way that the school where I taught, CAS 229 in the Bronx, was set up, it was a fifth through seventh grade middle school. Even though we think fifth grade usually is elementary school. Fifth grade's amazing. And so I would like to make that pitch to youngsters. And I say this from personal experience, not only as a school teacher, but more important as a student. When I lived in Denver when I was growing up, it was during the time of court-ordered desegregation. And so with the exception of 1 year, my whole K through 12 experience, I was bused from my Black neighborhood in Park Hill to white, majority white, or in some cases almost overwhelmingly white neighborhoods in Southeast Denver. But the individual who absolutely made a difference for me, and the reason why I'm a teacher now, a professor, was Ms. Romero, my fourth grade and sixth grade social studies teacher. She absolutely opened this door to just like thinking critically, thinking beyond the narratives that I'd become familiar with. This is as I was an elementary school student, and the seeds that she planted, got a chance to speak to her several years ago, and just thank her, were pivotal. So the answer to your question is simple. High school is great, middle school is fantastic, but the younger, the better.
what was Denver like, and what was that childhood experience like? Did you have a comprehension of the busing of why am I not going down the street with my friends?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. It was the comprehension was there, understood pretty well. Denver was one of the first cities north of the old Mason-Dixon line where corduroy busing happened prior to in Boston. And like Boston, there was some violence, not to the same extent as in Boston, but there was thankfully an empty bus that had been bombed shortly after the decision there in Denver, kind of a message sent. A significant number of white families chose not to have their kids bused to black sections of town. That left a committed minority who did, have their kids bused. But it was, Denver at that point, good friends and I will joke now, was like a cow town trying to be a big city. And some of the attitudes, it would not be unusual to hear the N-word, used. And I don't mean in the way that it's often used in a hip-hop context. I'm talking about, from white students directed at black students. And so there was that dynamic. And at the middle school that I attended, which was called a junior high school at the time, there was this added dynamic of there being almost equal numbers of white students, Mexican-American, Chicano students, and black students. And the black and brown students who were always at odds with one another. And then they even made the local news. It's like race wars brewing at, local junior high school. And so finally a few of us were like, why are we going at each other's throats? And the white kids are just kind of like sitting there just, popcorn in hand, watching this all take place. And so finally there was this effort to kind of squell that nonsense. But so the Denver experience was tough in some ways. I was in classes that were accelerated or advanced placement. There were just a handful or fewer of self-identified black students in these classes. So I never felt completely connected to white students. I was proud of my neighborhood, always proud of my, blackness. But there were moments when, I'd been called an Oreo, kind of not fully been embraced by like all the black students either. And so it was, it was just kind of this in-between kind of feeling. And it's a feeling, though not expressed in the same way, that I know some students of color now on college campuses, that was their experience in a K-12 context as well. So it's kind of interesting. College for me was just, though I was miserable the first month in New York City, I'd never been there, I didn't have money, so I didn't fly out. I just went, to Columbia. First month, I was so miserable, it wasn't even funny. If I had the resources, I would have just gone back home. But I ended up really, though I had an adversarial relationship with the school administration, the experience was amazing. I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Who did you read? Who did you look up to? Who were the leaders in your youth and adolescence?
Yeah. Well, I tell you, in many ways, when I was really young, someone who I looked up to was my dad, because my dad and my mom too, but my dad, because when he was a counselor at the University of Colorado, my dad, Leon Willis, was someone who went to school through the first year in middle school in Texas, but then part of the migration patterns, my grandma Bernice took him, his brother and sister, to Colorado Springs, Colorado. And so there, he was three-sport athlete, did really well in the classroom, went to the University of Northern Colorado, and really was so miserable, he dropped out. And then he went into the Air Force, became an air traffic controller, and ended up going back to school on the GI Bill, and eventually earned his master's degree in psychology, became a psychologist, but when he was a counselor, guidance counselor at the University of Colorado, he and a colleague, Dave Butler, exposed corruption in the program. I mean, they took a stand, and they ended up losing their jobs because of it. And they're like, look, we don't care if you're black, white, brown, it doesn't matter. You can't do this with the funds that are supposed to be going to programming. And so when they did this, they ended up losing their jobs. And so that kind of taking that kind of position was so important. And my mom, Verlin Willis, who just passed away last year, my dad in 2019, but my mom was a hero for my brothers and myself, because she would always take us to the public library when we were little. I mean, she this love of books and reading, I mean, she just absolutely instilled it in us, even though she only went to college for 1 year. She grew up in Portland, Oregon. That's Portland State, right? But because of financial, you know, difficulties, she didn't get to realize her dream, but it didn't keep her from it. She was an absolutely voracious reader, fiction, nonfiction, you know, you name it. So those were really kind of those key heroes. These are my folks eventually, you know, divorced when I was 10. You know, my dad stayed very much in our lives. You know, not a week went by we didn't, you know, spend time with him. And then in college, there was no Black Studies program, but there were individual professors. Professor Quandra Prettyman at Barnard College, a literature professor who was just amazing, and Marcellus Blount, who was also a professor of English at Columbia College, who was just amazing. But the real heroes, in many ways, were student activists. So, I mean, there were folks like Tannekiel Jones, Barbara Ransby, who were associated with the Coalition for Free South Africa. I can name so many other students. So these folks were really kind of guiding lights, because they were not only great activists, but they also like took their schoolwork seriously. It was kind of this mantra. It's like, okay, if the administration's going to kick us out for engaging in, you know, nonviolent direct action, fine, but don't kick yourself out by not taking care of business in the classroom. And so, I mean, we were up all night. You know, we developed study groups, but you know, that's what we did. And then finally, I kind of like familial heroes, grandparents were really important, because they'd all experienced Jim Crow firsthand, I mean, just palpably. I mean, this was what they knew. And my granddad, on my mom's side, my mom's father, John Henry Sylvester, went from sharecropping, was part of the Great Migration, left to go to Portland, left Louisiana. Was in Portland, Oregon, two jobs for almost 25 years. He was a laborer in a foundry, and he was a janitor in a number of different places, at a hospital, later on at the post office, sometimes 6 days a week, never called in sick until he got hurt at the foundry one time. Soft-spoken deacon at his church, just an extraordinary human being. And so, I mean, these are the folks on whose shoulders I stand.
What's next?
Well, I hope, particularly in terms of like just the immediate Skidmore moment, the thing that I hope next is just for Black Studies to grow. You know, we're fortunate to offer a minor, but I'd like to see us offer a major. I think that there's enough interest. I know there are enough faculty whose tenure home or whose structural home is in another department, but so much of their work is also in Black Studies and they're affiliated with the program. I think that they're definitely the critical mass of faculty foundationally is there. We'd love an additional line. That would be great, but you know, who wouldn't? But so that's the next step there. In terms of my own research, a project that I've kind of left alone but would like to come back to at some point. It's just a biography of James Forman, who was an activist with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Really interesting individual. And I'd like to return to that, as well as just work with just local historians. There's some amazing historians here, and just in terms of just unearthing the history of this region, from the Underground Railroad up to the current moment.
That's it. I want to thank you so much.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. No, it was an absolute pleasure.